This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program.
I'm able to live my life and still hit my goals.
Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
You know that wellness goal you set at the start of the year? It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. With 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and more. No fillers, no nonsense, just the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.
OnDeck is built to back small businesses like yours. Whether you're buying equipment, expanding your team, or bridging cash flow gaps, OnDeck's loans up to $400,000 help make it happen fast. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and earning thousands of five-star Trustpilot reviews, OnDeck delivers funding you can count on. Apply in minutes at OnDeck.com. Depending on certain loan attributes, your business loan may be issued by OnDeck or Celtic Bank. OnDeck does not lend in North Dakota. All loans and amounts subject to lender approval.
You can always count on Sunday to be the best day of the week. You can sleep in, go off your diet, spend the day in your pajamas, and go on, have that second croissant. You know what else you can count on every Sunday? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. And Season 2 begins Sunday, February 1st. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday relaxing companion, a chance to put your feet up, take a deep breath, and enjoy some stress-free listening time from the comfort of your favorite easy chair. And that second croissant, that stays between us. There's no judgment here. So make my podcast your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And rest assured, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen. So let's keep Sunday the best day of the week together. And thank you for listening.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is a special holiday edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Our special guests today are Christine Kewen and her husband, Mark, and they have a very timely story for the holiday season, because what matters more during Hanukkah and Christmas but family? And boy, does Christine Kewen have a family story to tell. Her book is called Family of Spies, a World War II story of Nazi espionage, betrayal, and the secret history behind Pearl Harbor. And it's about her discovery that her grandfather, his wife, and her father's sister were spying for Nazi Germany's ally, Japan, in Hawaii in the lead-up to the devastating Pearl Harbor attack 80 years ago this month. But let's let them tell the story. Christine and Mark, welcome to Spy Talk. You have written an extraordinary, gripping, even startling story. My first curiosity is, you could have just buried it like anybody else might have done, but you were propelled to investigate it and then write a book about it. How come? Why didn't you just let that sleeping dog lie?
Well, Jeff, I let it lie for about 30 years, right? I found out in 94 when I got a letter from a screenwriter, and it was really a difficult process to kind of come to terms with my family's past. And I would learn a little bit and then I put it away and couldn't really handle what I was facing and what I was finding out about my family. And so that was kind of what went back and forth for 30 years. So it wasn't until 2020 when we received a letter from my cousin in Germany, who asked if I wanted to know about my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And it just triggered everything all over again. We started connecting, telling stories. I was learning so much about what Otto and Friedel were doing prior to going to Hawaii and what they were doing in their younger years in Berlin. And then I still really wasn't going to write a book. And then I got connected with a historian, Stephen Harding, and he reached out because he was researching the family and wanted to do a book as well. And I thought about it and I looked at Mark and I said, hey, if anyone's going to tell my story, it's going to be me. I want to be the narrative of my family's story. So we have decided to write the book. I let Stephen know, and he sent me everything he had already found. Much of it I had already had, but he did send me a lot of information and was really pleased and said, you should be the one to tell the story. So it worked out really well.
And Mark, you were very much a collaborator in the book. A husband and wife team is extraordinary on its own. It's amazing to me, having been an author myself. It's amazing to me you're still married.
I'm right.
Depended on the day, but no, you're right. It was, she's got some strengths and I've got some strengths as far as research and writing, and she's got different strengths with her writing style, et cetera. So it really did. It worked out as a good collaboration.
It sure did work out. I mean, your book is getting high praise everywhere, over the top praise. What was it in that letter from Germany that really moved you off the dime, so to speak?
So I think what it was the letter was from my dad's first cousin, Lisa. So she was the daughter of Otto's brother, Bernard. And so she just basically said, I'm 86 years old. I would love to tell you about your grandfather if you're open to learning about it. And it was the first person that had really come to me and said, hey, I want to give you some information. I have information to share, because trying to get information out of my Aunt Ruth was just non-existent. She was so compartmentalized. It took a while to get my dad. I mean, I was able to talk with him about his childhood and pull some of his, but this is the first time anyone had reached out to me and said, let me tell you something, instead of me trying to be the one that's always digging through the files and trying to discover the truth.
What do you think was her motivation? I mean, she wasn't a Nazi sympathizer, was she?
No, I think she was 86 at the time. And I think she thought, you know, I might not be here a whole lot longer. And, you know, we need to pass down family stories, whether they're just family stories or whether they have a historical significance. And I think she felt like our story did, and she wanted to make sure that she passed that down to me.
So you've got three major
characters in this book. Otto, your grandfather, who was a spy for the Nazis at Pearl Harbor. Leopold, your uncle, who was a full-fledged Nazi SS official, full-blown, and the one who's, to me, was the most mind-blowing, was Ruth, who was your Aunt Ruth, who was, had dated, if that is the word, had an affair with Joseph Goebbels.
Of all people.
Even though, and this was one of the many mind-blowing revelations in the book, she was actually Jewish herself, because your grandmother had been married to a Jewish architect before she married your father. So just like, let's take them one by one, starting with your grandfather, Otto. Just tell us how he came to be a Nazi spy in Pearl Harbor. Walk us through his path.
You bring up the three main characters. Ruth is sort of the conduit through all of it, because Chrissy actually had contact with Ruth. She was the one that really kind of sparked the interest in you know, how this big mystery nobody wanted to talk about in the family kind of laid out. So when we started researching her grandfather, Otto, it was, you know, when we were getting info on him, it was a march to the truth. We knew that he was the only person ever tried and convicted for the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So that's astounding enough. And then the more that we uncovered about him, it's like, oh, he's high up in the Nazi party. Oh, he actually interviewed for a role of head of the Gestapo. So all this crazy stuff. So he became a spy really because he was joined the Navy in World War One. His ship was sank by the Brits. He was a POW for a couple of years. So he had a bent. He was kind of angry when he got out. The family had money. He kind of blew it with some spotty investments. And then about 1928, he joined the Navy secret police. He did that for a couple of years while he was running his own business, a coffee importing business. And then 1930, which is, you know, you can jump in here, but 1930, you know, the Nazis were just some floundering party up until 1929, 1930, as you guys well know. Had 3% of the vote in the national election. When the stock market crashed in 29 here, it was worldwide depression. Germany was hit hard. The Nazis took immediate advantage. Hitler was going around the country promising to, you know, release Germany from the shackles of the Treaty of Versailles and all that.
Make Germany great again.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And Otto and Leopold went to hear him speak in Kiel. And so they went to hear him speak with thousands of others. And he was, you know, talking about how he was going to raise Germany, you know, from the ashes and make him much more powerful. And, you know, he was automatically, you know, mesmerized. He joined the next day. Leopold joined, and he started with the Nazi party as a
brown shirt.
Yeah, I always forget the brown shirt. And that was before he went to work for Goebbels, right? So that was a big part of his. I'm sorry?
He was a stormtrooper,
exactly. And then Friedel joined as part of the NSF, and Ruth even joined in as the League of German Girls before she was old enough, right? She was a part of the Nazi youth. And so they kind of got swept up in the whole Nazi movement. And they, you know, they believed in his promises. And the family was really part of the Goebbels faction of the Nazi party, because the Nazi party was very splintered. And back then there were different competing areas. And so he was in the, he was part of the Goebbels group.
So get us to Otto going to Hawaii.
So that happened in 1935. Ruth had been having an affair with Goebbels, but the Nuremberg laws were getting ready to go into effect. And that actually made it illegal for Germans to have relationships with anyone from Jewish descent. And so Goebbels tapped Otto on the shoulder because he knew the Japanese were looking for Caucasians to go to Hawaii as basically sleeper spies. And so Otto went. And he took the whole family, including Ruth. So it got Ruth out of Germany and kind of eliminated the issue for Goebbels.
So if I understand correctly, Goebbels wants to get them, the whole family, out of Germany And so he comes up with this plan to have Otto be a spy. And presumably Ruth would go with us. But how did Goebbels know that Ruth, with whom he was having an affair, was Jewish?
You know, I don't think we really have the exact answer to that. The Germans were meticulous record keepers. So I don't know if someone tipped him off. I really don't have the answer to that because I haven't been able to uncover how he found out. But, you know, that when I was talking with my cousin Lisa, and she was talking about, well, you know, Ruth was Jewish. And I said, I do. And she said they just disappeared one day. One day they were here and the next day they were gone.
Did Ruth know she was Jewish?
She never answered that question. We never asked her directly if she knew she was Jewish, because anytime you talk to her about anything having to do with the family, the past, Pearl Harbor, growing up in Germany, she would just shut you out. I mean, she went weeks if Chrissy would bring it up without taking her calls.
And she did it to my cousins and everything as well. The minute they mentioned anything, she would get off the phone and you wouldn't hear from her.
Because obvious question is, she's her father was Jewish and she's having an affair with the minister of propaganda for a Nazi regime whose primary message was anti-Semitism. And the evil that the Jewish conspiracy bringing upon Germany.
Boils down, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about, or a lot, however you like, about what actually Otto did in the United States, what exactly his espionage was? And then I have some follow-up questions. But just what did he do, you know, with the signals, et cetera, et cetera?
So he was tried and convicted because he set up a set of signals to flash to the Japanese submarines or ships that were off the windward, the eastern side of the island. And it gave pretty detailed ship maneuvers, how many battleships were in, when they had left. The interesting thing about the signaling system is that they were only concerned with two sets of dates. December 1st through the 3rd, there were a set of signals, and December 4th through the 6th. So, you know, you can put two and two together and realize something's happening on the 7th.
But this was really rudimentary espionage. This is eyeballing American ships sailing in and out of Pearl Harbor and hanging laundry in the backyard to signal ships coming in or ships going out. That's about as basic as spying gets.
Right. And if you were in Hawaii, the bases were out in the open. You could drive by and park and watch Pearl Harbor. He would go to Hickam Field and Schofield Barracks and take pictures. I mean, there's shots of the planes wing to wing just set up, kind of gave the Japanese intel about how they were storing, you know, their equipment. And, you know, he was seen on multiple occasions going in and out the Japanese consulate. And so he was carrying a satchel. Now, do we know what was in the satchel? No, they were, you know, because when Pearl Harbor happened, the Japanese started burning everything that they had in the consulate. So, but they were able to rescue the signaling system.
But they were on to him, right?
They were on to him because he was supposed to be a sleeper spy. So in 1935, he was supposed to be laying low, not really, you know, causing a lot of attention, build himself within the community. But he didn't really do that. He was hosting lavish parties where he invited naval officials to come. One is at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel that actually was written up in the society pages. He would have people come to his house. So he wasn't really doing anything quietly. Part of the problem was that, you know, until 1939, they didn't have a full-time FBI office. So gathering intelligence was spotty and inconsistent. But in 1939, J. Edgar Hoover sent a memo saying, we need to dive into this family, this German family who is living lavishly. They have no visible means of income. And that's when they opened up the FBI office. That's when Robert Shivers came and started leading.
Another great character in your book, by the way.
And the FBI agent. Really getting intel.
Right. I want to ask you about Shivers, but just before we get there, one of the many things that surprised me is that that Otto gets dispatched by Goebbels to go to Hawaii as early to spy for the Japanese as early as 1935. Uh-huh. Now, you know, it's commonly known, you know, by 1940, the Japanese joined the Germany and Italy in the Axis alliance, right, that we went to war with. I don't remember knowing or that what the evidence was that there was that kind of German-Japanese alliance under the table, below radar, as early as that.
In 1935, they had an alliance. Nothing was signed yet, but they were sharing technology. They both were involved in and excited about a military group. And then in 1936, they actually signed the Comintern Pact, which basically was an anti-communism pact. And while it was targeting the Soviets, they were aligned as early as 35. You're right. The other tripartite act was signed later, but they were definitely, working in an alliance prior to that.
Tell us about Robert Shivers.
So he's an interesting character because he was his history was Southern, and so his grandfathers, were slave owners and Civil War, and so he grew up under that kind of a feel, and so he was relatively sickly, and so Hoover moved him to Hawaii to take this on because he thought that the fresh air would be good for him. It's really why he was tapped on the shoulder.
And Hoover liked him. They had it.
He did like him. Yeah. He got there, but Hawaii is a different place. I lived there for 3 years as a kid, and Hawaii is a different place. I mean, he was a white face among an Asian population, and nobody trusted him. So he had to really work hard to get infiltrated into some of these groups. He actually brought on a college girl, Sue, who he kind of ended up having her as kind of his adopted daughter, although they didn't truly adopt her, but she helped navigate him through the kind of the comings and goings and making connections and how you would, get contacts in that very tight-knit community. So he did that. They had, by the end of the investigation, they had 800 pages of documentation on the family. And that's really what we used for.
And Otto was his chief target. Right. He was, that's who he was looking at from the get-go. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there were others, but he was sent over there because Hoover had this memo and he said, we got to check these guys out. There's other stuff going on, but you got to focus on these guys to start.
And you got access to the these FBI files, which are incredibly detailed, and they go on for years. And I kept thinking as I was reading, why didn't Shivers move more quickly and arrest Otto?
Because they didn't have anything set in stone, right? I mean, they were walking around, they were taking pictures, but they couldn't prove anything. They were going back and forth to Japan and staying for weeks at a time. Even the whole family would go, but they couldn't, it was not illegal to do that. I mean, one time, a crazy story, Friedel was coming back.
Friedel
is my grandmother, and she was coming back from Japan. And the FBI saw she was on the manifest, so they went to the docks, and they were checking her luggage. They wanted to see if she was bringing anything back, and they couldn't find anything. Now, she did have several thousand dollars taped to her body underneath her clothes, which is odd behavior, but it's not illegal. So they had to let her go.
So afterwards, the day afterwards, Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. What did Shivers say? Did he say, I should have known there's more we should have done? Or, what was the reaction? Did this come up in the FBI files or any sense of it?
They were pretty excited about the job they did. The FBI felt like, hey, we got our guy. We should have known ahead of time. But we didn't know exactly who. Nobody expected it to be that incredible of an attack and that successful because Hawaii was thought to be like Gibraltar. There were newspaper articles for years that said, an attack on Oahu would just be stupid. So at the end of it, they, let's the best example I can give you. So right after, during the bombing, the FBI stormed the Japanese consulate, right? So they found them burning a whole bunch of papers and sensitive documents, et cetera. And one of those papers that was being burned was the signaling system that her grandfather had created. So they saved that, and then they got it decoded, you know, later on. But no, I think Shivers, if you know, all the documents that we read and interviews with him afterwards, they thought they did a pretty good job.
And they were all on the whole Ruth, Friedel, and Otto were all on the Nazi watch list. Like, so they had these watch lists that they were watching people, and they were rounded up after Pearl Harbor. They were rounded up and taken and put in internment camps on Sand Island. So they knew people they were watching, but I don't think they had the proof that they needed to actually arrest them before Pearl Harbor.
On Deck is built to back small businesses like yours. Whether you're buying equipment, expanding your team, or bridging cash flow gaps, On Deck's loans up to $400,000 make it happen fast. Rated A+ by the Better Business Bureau and earning thousands of 5-star Trustpilot reviews, On Deck delivers funding you can count on. Apply in minutes at OnDeck.com. Depending on certain loan attributes, your business loan may be issued by On Deck or Celtic Bank. On Deck does not lend in North Dakota. All loans and amounts subject to lender approval.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
It seems like we've skipped one important incident, however. The U.S. had cracked the Japanese diplomatic code. The U.S. was listening very closely. And this was Operation Magic, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And there was an intercept on December 6th, or maybe the day before. And the unit reported this up the chain that the Japanese, something big was about to happen. And the boss took it and said, I'll get back to you on Monday.
One of the that was Dorothy Eggers.
Historical footnotes here.
Yeah, absolutely. She went in and she translated it, and she took it to actually two different people. She took it to her direct supervisor and then one out, and then someone else above him. And they basically said, "Oh, you know what? Wait till Monday. You can go home, Dorothy." You know, and yeah, they did nothing with it. But yeah, you know, it's a history is made through a small misses sometimes.
So sure. Pearl Harbor happens at December 7th, and immediately the FBI moves on Otto and the rest of your family as they're rounding everybody up. They're rounding anybody with a connection to Japan, including Japanese Americans, loyal citizens, throwing them in. Another surprising thing I learned from your book is that Otto wasn't tried in federal court. He was tried in a military commission. Now, we all knew about the military commissions that were set up for the Nazi saboteurs who landed on Long Island on a submarine and engaged in sabotage. And in fact, that became a historic case, went up to the Supreme Court. Could you try these people and execute them by a military court? It, as I and many others reported years later, it was the inspiration for Bill Barr to suggest that we use military commissions to try Al-Qaeda suspects rather than put them in federal court in the United States. Otto is tried and convicted, but he doesn't spend much time. He was originally sentenced to execution. He was going to be executed.
Exactly.
Right. And then he's out within a year while Japanese Americans are still interned throughout the war all over the United States. How and why did that happen?
Well, that's a complicated issue. I mean, he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death, but the defense they, you know, the attorney general immediately saw some issues there because he had done his spying in a time of peace. And so the highest and the most punishment you can give is 50 years hard labor. And so they actually were waiting for the opinion from the submarine saboteurs case to come out. And when they said, yes, we can execute them, that created a problem for Otto's conviction because his was in the time of peace. So they commuted it to 50 years prison. So that happens. And he goes to Leavenworth. And so after, you know, the war is over, so he spent 4 years in Leavenworth.
One last ditch effort,
he sends a letter to the War Department and basically says, I didn't get a fair trial. You know, he, you know, everyone in that military tribunal, including his own lawyer, were military. So, you know, they looked at it and they said, you know, we don't want to do this again. We don't want a chance that he gets off. Let's just get him out of the country.
They sent him to Ellis Island,
where he sent for another 2 years.
Yeah,
because they never sent him. They never did anything with him. They just let him stay on Ellis Island. And finally, there was some memos that were sent down again by the attorney general. And they're like, why is he still here? You need to get him out of the country. Well, the INS goes, okay, well, we'll let him go. And they let him go. And he was walked into New York, went to Yorkville, and he started trying to work there so that he could come up with his own funds so that he could buy his passage back to Germany.
Chris, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, I think the intrigue of the case and everything is interesting, but I think really what the narrative of your book does is to focus on the emotions around what it means to be, you know, in a family that has had this history before and to sort of uncover it. And I just want listeners to know that there's a tremendous amount of, you know, emotional story here as well as espionage story. And can you just tell us what happened to the children, one of whom was your father?
Yeah.
When they came and arrested them right after the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
Yeah. So, you know, it was the night of, it was like in the middle of the night on December 8th. So early morning of December 8th. And my dad told me a story about waking up to hearing his mother screaming and banging on the door. And he went out and there was two men with guns on his family. And
he was
15 at the time.
15. And his brother was?
Nine.
Nine.
And
okay.
So they left Hans at the house, but they took my dad, Ruth, my Aunt Ruth, and my grandmother and grandfather, and they took them and put them into the internment camp. And they investigated them for 4 months. I mean, my father talked about going back and forth and having meetings with Robert Shivers and trying to, you know, understand why he was still being held, because he didn't get it. He came over here when he was 9 years old. He went to school here. His formative years were here. And it was really difficult for him to kind of believe that you know, the United States would think he was as dangerous to national security as his parents or some of the Japanese that they had captured and were in the
Would you say it was a kindness on the part of your grandfather not to involve the children, or at least the older one, in their espionage?
I don't know that it was a kindness, Jeff. I think it was just a matter of circumstance and who they were having doing what. I mean, my father was feeding the chickens when Takeo Yoshikawa came to the house to talk to Otto about testing a two-way radio and paying him $14,000. So, I mean,
really quick, Takeo Yoshikawa is Japan's spy on the ground there that came over in 1941. He graduated top of his class at the Edojima Naval Academy over there. So he was a super spy that ended up being kind of his handler, Otto's handler, her grandfather.
And you think about the trial, right? I mean, so this trial's being held, and it's a thick, you know,
transcript
of what was asked. And I was most shocked that my father and my uncle Hans, who was only nine, had to testify against their father. They had to go on for the prosecution. And, you know, I think at 15, my dad probably had some idea, you know, what was the result, you know, what was going to be the result and the ramifications of testifying against his father. But Hans had no idea. I mean, he was 9 years old. Sure. So I don't know that as a mother, that was one of the harder things that I learned, because as a mother, I would never put my kids in that situation. I mean, I would never want to compromise their youth and their childhood or their adulthood. And so that was one of the things that was really, really hard for me, Karen, because I couldn't understand how maybe my grandfather or my grandmother, how could either one of them have put them in that situation?
And yet there is such an attempt by the family to get your father, and maybe you should talk about this, not me, but to get your father to re-acknowledge them, come back to Germany, you know, form some kind of relationship, however tenuous, with them. Do you want to tell us how that played out or didn't play out, as the case may be?
Yeah, so the Hans, Ruth, and Friedel were returned to Germany in the last prisoner exchange of the war. And Friedel had been sending letters to my dad. He was staying in a foster home. He was going to high school. Come with us. Come to Crystal City. They had been moved to Crystal City, Texas by that point. And they were kept saying, please come. Go back to Germany with us. We'll be a family. And my dad would write letters back to his mother and to his sister and say, you're German. I'm not. I'm not going back. And so he never saw his mother again. He walked away from the family when he was only 16, graduated high school, denounced his citizenship, and actually fought in Okinawa.
Right. He enlisted early on.
Yeah, he did.
Was that a reaction to the case?
I think so. I think he was trying to show his allegiance to America and to the country. I mean, everyone was joining. When you were 18, that's what you did. You joined the military. So he joined the army because I think he loved America. He didn't like what the Nazis were doing. And he was just, he wanted to be an American. And so you fast forward now and the war's over. My dad's in college. And my grandfather now has been released into New York City. And he actually calls my dad and says he wants to see him. And, you know, I was kind of shocked my dad went. But I think my dad wanted to go because he wanted to ask his father if he had really done it. Right. Did you really do this? And then I think Otto was going to try and talk him into coming back to Germany so that the family could be together again. And my father told me about this meeting, and it always really was hard and difficult for him because he could never get a straight answer. And, you know, he ended up getting up and he hugged his dad and he left and he never saw his dad again. Mm-hmm. And his dad ended up going actually to Argentina until 1955 and then went back to Germany and died in 1956.
I'm wondering what the reaction has been to your book, first among your friends and relatives. We know some of that. You tell some of that in the book. But then the larger public, what kind of reaction are you getting from readers and others? And I wondered even if neo-Nazis have, you know, reached out to you in some way.
Well, fortunately, no for the neo-Nazis. But I will tell you, it's been, you know, everybody says, oh, writing the book was probably healing for you. Huh. And it was, but really speaking to some of the community groups, I'm speaking with the Jewish community centers, talking about my story and having them ask me questions. And I think that's where I'm really starting to heal, because I have come to the conclusion that we don't carry the transgressions of past generations. We just don't. It's not our responsibility. And I think I always for 30 years had done that. My friends knew nothing. I've been in a book club for 25 years. And when they read my book, there were several of them who goes, I had no idea. It wasn't something I talked about, but I do feel
were
like.
Were they shocked?
Were they shocked? Yeah.
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 Along those lines, how have your own children processed this information that they are related to a family of Nazis?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've had 30 years to process it, and it took a long time. When I first started talking to, we started talking to the kids, I think they were nervous as well. They weren't sure what the kickback or pushback was going to be. But, you know, over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years since we've been writing it, I think they've really come to understand the story. They've read the book. They're extremely supportive. You know, I would hope that, you know, no one would, you know, react negatively to them. They are so many generations away. And they, so yeah, I think it was hard at first, but I have a niece who found out a year ago, and the emotions she was having were the same emotions I had 30 years ago. And so I was talking with her about those, and we were going through and, you know, crying together and, you know, telling her you're not a reflection of your great, great grandfather. I mean, it was just a lot to kind of go through. But, you know, she called me the other day, and one of the things she said to me that I thought was so powerful is she said, looked at me and she said, "Our family story isn't over yet." And I'm like, "You're right, it's not. I'm my family story. My kids are my family story." So I think we're changing that narrative on what it means.
And that's the bottom line, that you don't carry the sins of your father, or in this case, your grandfather.
It was hard in stretches, though, I will say, Jeff. You know, we got pieces of information over the years, and some were, you know, horrifying. So about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, we knew the story, right? We knew that her grandparents were bad. Her uncle Leopold was bad. Leopold's grandson, Chrissy had reached out to and made contact with, sent us a picture of his grandfather, Leopold. It was a wedding photo. And so it came across the computer screen, and we opened it up, and Chrissy froze, because it was a picture of this beautiful woman in a white gown, a beautiful bride, and Leopold on his wedding day, and he's dressed in full Nazi regalia. He's got the swastika on his arm. He's got the dagger hanging from his belt. It was horrifying. And really, at that point, Chrissy was like, this is too much. I don't want to do this anymore. So, you know, there were pieces of this story that were almost too hard to take.
This story, this kind of story, has been alive for decades in Germany itself, of course, with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of German families having to deal exactly with this question of the Nazi in the closet, and the shock and dismay of younger people to find out their grandfathers or their great-grandfathers were ardent Nazis. It's even coming up in a way in the current German debate over rearming. They still carry that history, that odious history, and the idea of Germany acquiring, say, nuclear weapons scares the bejesus out of a lot of people. So anyway, it's really an important book with important themes in it, on top of being a riveting spy story. So thanks for coming on the show and spending time talking with us about it.
Well, thank you. I think it's an important story as well. I think it's a piece of history that's untold, and it belongs to be part of the narrative. And I've talked with a lot of people that have read the book, and they're not big history buffs. They're not going and reading At Dawn We Slept from start to finish, but they've told me that this book takes history and puts it into a format that they can actually learn from, and they can, it actually empowers them, or, you know, makes them want to go and research a little bit more. And so that's what's really unique about Family of Spies, is that it does take this piece of history and put it into a narrative that people can read, because it's like telling a story. It's like telling, you know, handing down from generation to generation.
And who was it that the history is not over? It's not even past.
I think that was Faulkner. William Faulkner.
William Faulkner.
Yes.
Anyway. Thanks, you guys, Christine and Mark, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having
us. We wish you a very merry and serene Christmas. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark. Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.